Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Lee Hutchison, and welcome to Filibuster, part of the Nerd Party Network, where pods beat loud into your ears each and every day. So if you're listening to this on your phone while travelling, at work, working out, you've probably got the choice between music and a podcast, and today we're combining the two and having a musical-themed episode. So we're finally going to be able to talk about Hearts Beat Loud, we'll have an interview with the writer-director of the film, and we're going to pick our favourite films or documentaries about music, musicians, or the biz itself. But before we dive in, Dallas, how are you?
I'm very well. How's yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. Yeah, it's been a long time coming, us being able to actually talk about Hearts Beat Loud. We've been, you know, kind of on each other about this since June, since you unfortunately missed it at the film festival.
I know. I had a train to catch that meant that I missed this particular screening, and it was one that had sort of gone under the radar until about the day of, and I went, oh, actually, I really quite fancy that. Missed it, and then of course saw all the tweets coming out from people who had seen it saying, oh, this is one of the best films of the year, oh, I was in floods of tears and stuff, and I'm like, damn it. And then of course, as the way it works with independent cinema and very small releases and stuff like that, it's taken a couple of extra weeks before I could actually finally see it in the cinema. But I think you've seen it twice now by this time as well.
Yeah, I have, yeah. And I'm almost, once, even though you've had this extended wait for it, almost feels kind of lucky that you've even had the chance to see it. It seems to have got a really small rollout here in Scotland in particular.
Yeah, no, I think it's on a split screen at my local independent cinema, so it's got like two showings a day for a week, and that'll be it, and then it'll be one that will be probably shared sort of word of mouth and sort of passed around with people, and then really sort of find its home on streaming, and where, which, you know, ironically is probably, you know, part of the film's storyline as well.
Absolutely.
Like finding things and sharing things on Spotify and stuff. So
it's obviously, you've had this long wait to go see this movie. You tweeted about it yesterday. I've not seen a review or anything yet. Did it live up to the hype first and foremost, or did all these people banging on about it, in particular me, for months, ruin it in any way?
I think it did live up to the hype, but only because it was a film that I went in thinking it was going to be a certain type of film, and then it wasn't. And I find myself really enjoying it for not being the film that I thought it was going to be. And I can explain a bit more about that later, but what was it about Hearts Beat Loud that you fell in love with straight away on your first screening?
Yeah, like, I remembered when we did our preview pod all the way back in, like, episode 98. Here we are in the 130s now. And I remember saying, like, just reading the little introduction, it was like, Nick Offerman and his daughter make a band. Like, I'm a sucker for music, like coming-of-age movies about making bands, like something like Sing Street was one of my favourite movies in the past few years. And I was really, really excited to see that movie. And, you know, I hadn't heard really anything about it, so it was going to be a bit of a surprise. So, yeah, I went into it kind of, you know, blind as usual. And then I was kind of totally blown away. Like, the music in particular was really just spot on, and I just really liked the diversity of the movie. You know, that we have this, you know, amazing young black woman playing the daughter, who I just thought, I'd never heard of really Kiersey Clemons before, even though I think she's going to be in the Flash movie. You know, she seems to have been really gaining a bit of traction in the past few years, but you watch a movie like that and you're like, who is this person? You're just immediately blown away by that person. And then Nick Offerman is someone I love from Parks and Recreation. I love his stand-up, which obviously involves a bit of a musical element together. But the one thing with him is he's rarely ever been the leading man in a movie. Sometimes he's been lucky to even have like a couple of scenes in a film, which is always a bit frustrating. You're like, this guy's amazing. You know, I watched him each and every week for 22 minutes over, what, 7 years on Parks and Rec? And I always loved him. And Sasha Lane, you know, she was so good in American Honey, but she seems to have sort of, her career has been a bit quiet since then. But with this and The Miseducation of Cameron Post coming in a few weeks' time, you know, her career seems to really starting to come together. So it just was brought together a lot of different things. And when you first hear the title song, Hearts Beat Loud, when they have their jam session, that like struck an emotional chord with me. I just thought it was such a beautiful song. And you know, at the end when they're performing their first and last ever gig, all the three different songs, you know, Everything Must Go, Blink and Hearts Beat Loud, it was just so good. It was like, it was just lightning in a bottle. You're watching it and you're going, what is this? Like, this is just, it's so good for the soul. It makes you feel so happy. I don't know what I expected, because it feels so long ago, because I didn't maybe have much expectation. I didn't have people coming out going, oh, I cried, or I loved it, you know, when's it coming out? With this, it was just like, and it was just such a euphoric experience, and it held up on that second watch as well. You know, I took my girlfriend, who found the scenes with sort of Ted dancing a bit boring, but, you know, some of the scenes obviously with the band and the pairing, you know, really struck a chord. And I really liked how it, you know, slight spoilers here, like there was some scenes where you think it's going to go in a certain direction, which could be a bit cliche, it could be a bit of like, let's indulge the male character here, but it doesn't go that way at all. And I just think it's just a film that will get, people will find it on Netflix or wherever, and it will become one of their favorite movies of the year. And I can see it being popping up on all these different lists you get at the end of the year, you know, a David Ehrlich video or something like that, and people going, oh, what's that film? I'm going to check it out, because it is destined to be a film people adore, I think. What about for yourself? What was it you maybe expected and were surprised by?
I think it was something you just touched upon there, which was the how the plot progressed and stuff, because, you know, this starts off, I mean, with a, you know, the Nick Offerman character has been running a vinyl shop in Red Hook, Brooklyn for 17 years. But now the sort of, you know, rent control sort of era is over, and he's basically being, he's now looking, he's going to have to force to close his shop and look to make money a different way in order to put his daughter through medical school. And, but he's still sort of really keen on music and is still wanting to, you know, he's always wanted to sort of jam with his daughter and have these jam sessions once a week. And, you know, they've finally recorded the song, which is one of the best edited scenes I think I've seen this year, the sort of how Brett Haley's sort of constructed that scene and edited it, how layer upon layer as they bring in more instruments and more sort of different layers of the track and stuff like that. I thought it was just fantastic for the first track, which was Hearts Beat Loud. I thought it was just stunning. And yeah, Kirstie Clemons' voice is fantastic, and I think I've seen her in a couple of things. She was in the Flatliners remake and Bad Neighbours 2, nothing really to,
yeah, I'd forgot she was in Bad Neighbours 2
to shout home about, but I think this is definitely the film that will put her on the map and make her the next sort of indie star. If it is indeed her own voice, I mean, then wow, she's got a fantastic voice, and I think the two of them just spark off brilliantly. But I was thinking that this was going to go in a way where it was going to be one of those films where, you know, they've got to put on one gig in order to save the store, you know, damn the man, save the empire, this sort of thing where, you know, they use their song and the new band status to try and, you know, save the store and, you know, this institution in Brooklyn, stuff like that. But, you know, I don't want to spoil it too much, but let's just say it doesn't really go that way. And I actually admire it more for that, that it is actually purely about the sort of father-daughter relationship and the nice, how the way they sort of turn it on its head. And it's, he's the one that's really needs to grow up. And the daughter's actually been the adult in the relationship for a while, ever since her mother passed and his late wife passed. And, you know, it's got some great supporting characters, like you say, Sacha Lane. But I mean, Toni Collette is on a roll in 2018 between like this and Hereditary. I mean, she's one of those actresses that I would watch in anything. And actually, she's got some great vocals as well in a brief glimpse at a karaoke scene, mm-hmm. as well. And yeah, I mean, the final, so actually, it isn't the final scene. It's, again, it's one of those films where I thought them playing together in the store was going to be the final scene, but it turned out it wasn't. And again, you know, it's just one of the great sort of choices that the writer-director makes in this. And I have already downloaded Hearts Beat Loud onto my iPod, and it's on my training run now. And
it's a good one to have on there, isn't
it? Download the whole album. I think, yeah, because it's one of those great songs that sort of starts off slowly but builds and builds. And then, yeah, you just want to be sort of dancing around at the end of it. And it's just, yeah, it's a fantastic song. And hopefully if there's any, you know, justice in the world, they can do an Oscar push, and maybe Nick Offerman and Kirstie Clemons could be performing that at the best, the Oscars for Best Original Song.
I will be stunned if this doesn't get an Oscar nomination for Best Music. I just thought, like, you're watching that thinking, it would be an injustice if this isn't nominated for Popular Movie, Or, well, I suppose only it made $3 million at the box office from a $2 million budget, but you know, that's beside the point. But yeah, like, it definitely deserves an Oscar nomination for that song and stuff. And sometimes these songs, when they get nominated, that, you know, spikes up a movie big time. And absolutely. And you know, it's, I think I liked as well that I kept expecting those cliches to happen, that the Spotify royalties are going to come in and it's enough to save the shop, or you know, that big show is going to come in, and it doesn't go down that route. And I really liked it. I think it's always honest and true to the characters, and you know, especially Kiersey Clemons' character. Like, it never once feels like, you know, she's being railroaded. She is, you know, firm, and she's such a strong female character. And I can't wait to see her in more things and more leading roles. And I can't wait to see Sasha Lane in The Miseducation of Cameron Post in the kind of coming weeks as well. So yeah, it's an exciting movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, she's a very sort of grown-up character. She knows what she wants. She isn't going to let anyone change it, you know, even though the fact that, you know, her dad is going through financial troubles and is having to give up the store and whatever, she's still focused on this medical career, even though, you know, she gets a girlfriend halfway through. And that was another amazing thing I liked about the film, is that it treats you know, a lesbian relationship as absolutely normal. And this was in a 12A, which, you know, is great for sort of representation on screen as well. And it's also, yeah, I mean, we've had Love, Simon earlier this year, which was a 12A, but it seems like we're now seeing the turning of the tide, and we're, you know, this sort of thing, it's not ever mentioned. It's like Nick Offerman's character never even mentions, you know, the fact he's clearly accepted a long time ago that his daughter's a lesbian. And you know, it doesn't play any sort of other role in the fact that this is her relationship and this is what it is. And that's just fantastic. And yeah, no, it's just a really, really good sort of, you know, heartwarming, you know, feel good film, and one that I hope many, many people sort of shout about and the word of mouth spreads and people get a chance to see it wherever they can.
Absolutely. So now seems an opportune moment. We released this interview during sort of the Edinburgh Film Festival. I got to speak with co-writer and director Brett Haley about the making of this movie, the music, the casting, you know, the representation as well in this movie. So for those who maybe missed that episode, you know, we released so many during the festival, it did become a bit of an avalanche. So here's just an opportunity to hear that interview. And then on the other side, me and Dallas will join you again. I just want to thank you so much for talking with me and bringing your film here at the festival. I saw it yesterday, and I went in. I try and go and be surprised by the movies. You know, I remember reading the programme and went, Nick Offerman, musical. Okay, that's enough for
me.
Yeah,
sure.
Went into it, and I came out. You know, I felt emotional. I almost felt like I just floated out of the cinema. And it was like, but you know what these press and industry screenings are like? So straight-faced, yeah. You know, five movies a day. People just like wiping the tears, and I was like, when I tell the director this tomorrow, he's gonna be like, oh, I've heard that bullshit before and stuff like that. But I was like, one of the guys went, oh, I'm interviewing as well. I was like, right, well, tag team. If he doesn't believe me, you can back
well
me
that's
up
very
on this
nice
one.
To hear. I mean, it's definitely why, you know, definitely the idea of the movie was to create those kind of emotions. It's a feeling. People call it a feel good movie,
yeah. And
I think what they mean is they're just feeling
a
lot. And feeling anything these days other than just dread and misery is a good thing.
Absolutely. So how do you go around, like, because I was so curious of, like, how this came to become, like, a movie and how it all kind of structures together is, like, do you write a script and then, like, it's you just leave a generic insert song here and then someone comes in, right? What's the process for writing this script to kind of filming a script?
Well, we knew we were going to have at least, you know, three or four, and in some versions of the script, five original songs. And it was tough to kind of figure out how the songs did. We wanted to make sure that they were doing narrative lifting, that they weren't just songs that were there to be cool songs, but rather they were moving the story along or characters' journey along. Mm-hmm. And so we just worked hand in hand with Keegan DeWitt, who wrote all the songs and did the score, and said, look, how can we, you know, so it was a back and forth. Sometimes we knew what song was going to go there because it was already done, and other times it was insert song here, and then talking with Keegan about this is what we need this song to do.
So, like, when I first heard that Hearts Beat Loud song, like, blown away, and I was thinking, like,
I can't wait. It better be on Spotify when I get to the cinema. And there's a nervous thing. I typed it in. Like the first five hits were some random things. And it was like, scroll down, original soundtrack.
Yeah.
What was your reaction when you kind of first heard that song completed for the first time and knowing this could be the kind of heart piece of your movie?
Well, it's amazing to hear Kiersey sing it. You know, I've heard Keegan sing it, you know, in demos or in the older version of the song or whatever. And then when Kiersey sings it, you go, whoa. Like, things are nothing against Keegan. He's an amazing vocalist as well. But there's something about having it be that pop song and that female, you know, it was really special. And Kiersey did all the vocals in the film are live. Mm. So the version you'll hear on Spotify or whatever is a studio version. And the version that you hear two different versions in the movie that are different, that are live. Mm-hmm. You know, she's actually singing.
And with like that, like I was totally unfamiliar with Kiersey when I watched the movie, and I was like, looked up and I was like, oh, I recognize her from bits and pieces.
Yeah.
What was the casting process to find someone like that? Because I can imagine it's so difficult to find someone that's the perfect fit for...
It was, yeah, it was difficult. And I've just known about Kiersey, and I've always wanted to work with her. Mm-hmm. I think she's super talented. And then I did some research, and I found out she could sing. And I dove deep and was like, oh yeah, she's like an actual, she can like really sing. So I just had a feeling about it, and I talked to Nick and I said, look, I'm gonna make her the offer. So it wasn't an audition at all. It was like a gut call
on
my part.
And it's totally paid off as well, because like, you can almost see this movie being the one that just opens her up to
the world. I think so. I hope so. I mean, I think she's about to become famous regardless of my or she is famous, but getting bigger and bigger regardless of this movie. But I do think you can see her true talents on display here,
because it was so great to see Sasha Lane in a movie as again. Like American Honey was one of my favorite films of that year, and then I think she popped up in one other role since that's caught my attention. It's like when this was like, oh brilliant, she's back in this as well. It was like a difficult filling all these different kind of, you know, the supporting roles. You've got people like Sasha Lane, Ted Danson, Toni Collette.
Everybody, I think, wanted to be a part of the positivity surrounding this film and just being on. I mean, Sasha told me, like, this is the first movie I've gotten to do where nothing bad happens to me. You know, or something really tragic. Like, she's like, I just get to fall in love and kind of be sweet and real. And I think they both really, I think, related to what was happening on screen and the reality of it.
Did you have to give Ted Danson much direction for working behind a bar?
You actually do. He's not a natural. And people think that he would be, but he's not.
Probably thought that was going to be an easy day's directing. Yeah. And then it's like, no.
It was a little more, it was a little bit more of that than I thought. But Ted he's such a gentleman and such a great, great guy.
And then kind of with like, there was one thing that was, I was curious as well, like I always, especially for a director like you, I always think nothing's by accident, everything's by design. It's like the record shop. How did you go around picking all the different vinyls that are there in the background, the music that's playing? Was it like making the perfect mixtape for you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was sort of like a mix of what can you afford, because, you know, you have to get the right to show these records. And obviously, the song is playing. That's incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's even an unknown song. The money is—it's a lot. And this is a very small film, so it was a challenge. It was like sort of figuring out, well, what can I put in the movie that we can afford, but that also means something to me, to the characters, to the movie. So it was like, you know, it was something that I took. I obviously had help, but it was really my vision of what would be in this. And I remember, like, I think we cleared like the Universal music catalog, and my production designer just said, look, here are the albums we can show, which ones do you want up? And I was like, Rain Dogs and Billie Holiday and, you know, Pet Sounds and, you know, like, I just picked kind of my favorites and put them up there, and I you know, so yeah, nothing is there by like, oh, whatever. You know,
with like, obviously this is your most recent film with Nick Offerman, and it sounds like you two kind of collaborated together there when you were talking about casting Kiersey. What was it like working with Nick Offerman again? And it's one of those ones, it's amazing again to see him as the leading man in a movie, not the sidekick or the comedy role that plays in. Like, he has got all the leading man potential.
He does. I mean, he can kind of do it all, I think. And I really enjoyed working with Nick on The Hero, and I just got a great energy and vibe from being around him, and so we wrote this part with him in mind and hoping that he would do it. And he agreed and kind of jumped on board and helped us with a lot of different things. Like, he was really the reason we got Ted Danson to be in the film, because they're friends. Like, yeah. He made the Jeff Tweedy cameo happen. Like, he really puts his money where his mouth is and supported the film when we needed his support. And he's been a great, proponent for the film on social media and stuff. And, that's what you're kind of looking for. But he's also just an incredibly gifted actor that I think people take for granted. They take him for granted because he's Ron Swanson.
Yeah.
And they forget that Ron Swanson is a creation. That's not who Nick is. Mm-hmm. Nick created this incredibly memorable character, along with the Parks and Rec writing staff. They created this character that will live forever and is iconic, but that's not who Nick is. No. That's not the sum of his parts. He can do so much more, and I hope that people see this film and see that.
Especially if you watch like a stand-up comedy, like when the idea of like, oh, he's in a musical or he's doing music, it's like, well, that's no surprise if you see his, or he can put a tune together.
Absolutely,
and stuff.
Absolutely.
And what was it kind of like with the, with like going into a movie like this, what kind of movies did you sort of draw from? Because there's been in the past few years, there's been some really successful small movies, for example, like Once, Sing Street, that have been about kind of bands and have been so successful. And other times, it's almost cliche trope ones that you see, oh, I've seen this sort of one before.
Right.
What were the ones that you sort of looked at as the movies that might inspire you? And
well, I mean, I think Carney is an obvious, he really excels in this genre. Mm-hmm. He's sort of like the master of this genre. And so while inspired by his work, I didn't want to copy his work. I didn't want to try to go where he went with his films. And I think Sing Street and Once in particular are so great. And I didn't want to kind of tread in those similar territories. Mm-hmm. And I think he's got a great sort of romantic center to all of his. There's like a romance element. Yeah. So we wanted to take it into a family dynamic more than it was a romance. But I think the other movies that really inspired the film were High Fidelity, That Thing You Do, a Japanese film called Linda, 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 and Inside Llewyn Davis.
Mm-hmm. And do you think with something like where like High Fidelity very much felt like a movie of certain people's generations, and now we're seeing people making movies where it's been inspired by that sort of even dialogue and use of music, do you now see that we'll see more filmmakers inspired by those kind of 90s, early 2000 movies?
I hope so. I mean, I think they don't make them like that much anymore, and I enjoy those types of film. I miss studio movies from the 90s. Mm-hmm. I do. Like, I love a good Field of Dreams or High Fidelity. Like, these are studio movies, which seems crazy. Like those are indie movies now. So I do miss the days of the $20 to $50 million adult studio movie. And I think in some ways my movies are that. They, in another world, they would be a studio film. But because studios don't often make films like this anymore, they're indies, They're even smaller than they should be. Yeah.
Was there much nerves from, like, studios about this kind of movie and investing in it? Or were they, like, blown away by the script?
Well, no studio invested in this movie, so...
But that must have been frustrating. So why would they not invest in a movie kind of like this? What was their sort of feedback to that?
I don't know. I think if you're not based on a famous book, comic book, or whatever, novel, it's got to be some kind of IP.
Yeah. Do you think that's why, like, we're looking at those movies or those other things, like, studios would put money at it?
They would last time some... I mean, it's like... '99 or whatever when The Matrix came out. It's like The Matrix was on TV the other day, and I was like, that's crazy that they threw a bunch of money at an original idea.
And was that kind of nervous for you then, without that studio backing, going out and making this movie?
No, it's all I've ever done.
Yeah.
It's my fourth time doing it. I'm used to this. I'm used to going out and spending people's money and getting their money back.
Right. And
so every time I've been able to get their money back and then some. Mm-hmm. I've made a lot of people... I've been able to take a small amount of money, make a movie that feels hopefully bigger than what it was made for, and get my investors their money back and then some. So it's what I'm used to. I'm not used to studios embracing what I'm putting out. Maybe one day they will, and that would be great. But you know, you got to just keep making what you love.
Because I was wondering as well with this movie, and it seems to be a kind of recurrent trend here in the film festival. There's so many great movies here that are showcasing representation, whether it's on the camera, behind the camera.
Yeah.
We've had blind directors here. We've had females writing leads for female lead actors.
Yeah.
And it was what I loved most about this movie was like it's the use of race, and that it's just like it's a father with a mixed race daughter, and that's perfect. And it's like there's no story behind that, and
nope.
It's just accepted. And you know, on top of that, it's a character that could be bisexual, lesbian, who knows.
Yeah.
And that's exciting. Was there any sort of, how did that kind of come around, that idea? Was that something that was originally in the script, or
yeah.
was it just like blind casting?
It was always in the script that she would be what mix, what race was open.
Mm-hmm.
We were looking at a lot of different things to begin with. But when we found Kiersey, it was sort of like that's our girl, and we're going to go in that direction. And so we then sort of leaned into that. Mm-hmm. But it was always never going to be mentioned, never going to be an issue. We had versions of the script where we did talk about it
yeah.
in the script. And we thought, you know, it's more powerful to just let it be
mm-hmm.
and not make it sort of a... we felt there was power in just allowing mm-hmm. it to breathe and allowing it to be represented as it is without... being a plot point, without being focused on.
Because it's like that great line Frank has where it's like, you got a boyfriend,
yeah.
you got a girlfriend.
Yeah.
It's like, in other movies, that would have been the big moment and stuff like that. Whereas here, it's like, that's life.
Yeah,
that's what
and he says girlfriend first, which I think is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you have a new girlfriend? And then she's like, kind of ignoring him. And he's like, boyfriend? And that's a weirder... So it shows that not only does he know that they've had this conversation... It also shows that he's open to whatever decision
mm-hmm.
she might make, and then that she's allowed to date anyone she wants
mm-hmm.
to date, and that there would be no judgment waiting for her. That's just refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
There are obviously parents like this, and there are kids that live like this, but it's also nice to put it out there without it being the big plot point of the movie, just that it's there
mm-hmm.
so that people can say, wow, that... Not it feels good, but it also maybe does represent, I think, where we're going.
Do you think
more.
That would have been one of those ones, if it had studio backing, that would have maybe made more conversations
Probably.
About that and the characters?
Well, there's a lot of need for faux conflict, right? Faux external conflict.
Yeah.
Oh, well, the landlady should have, you know, ulterior motives.
Yeah.
And oh, the dad should be upset when he finds out his daughter's dating another woman. Well, we're not making that movie.
And it was one of those ones, sometimes you think you've been conditioned with a few things, thinking, I bet they're going to get a big Spotify royalty check
yeah.
just as they're closing.
Yeah,
it's like,
you,
nope, he just, that's it.
Yeah, there's all those tropes that you're expecting from the movie are just sitting there
yeah.
waiting, and we just don't go there. We just simply allow it to feel organic and real and grounded, and there's still a lot of conflict in the film. The film is all about conflict and letting go and change and all of the things that come with this journey we call life.
And obviously it's the UK premiere tonight, and I see it's rolling out, and I think it's this weekend it's rolling out in so many American cities.
Yeah.
I've already said to some of my friends in our group chat, like, go see this, go see
yeah,
this, go see
great.
This.
Thank
What's
you.
Been the reaction from people that have seen it, that have come out and spoke with you and shared their thoughts on social?
It's been overwhelming, at least when you just look at the Twitter feed. It's been really lovely to just see, you know, and I try to interact. I'm not much of a social media person, but I've been trying to interact online with people and say thank you for coming out. You and I had a little interaction
yeah, yeah, yeah.
yesterday, and it's like, I love to see that. I love to see people coming out of the movie
mm-hmm.
and saying, this movie moved me, and
yeah.
it made me feel good, and it made me feel things, and thank you for the, you know, the queer representation.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for this representation. Thank you. So it means a lot to have people respond to your movie in the way that they have been. And it seems like this is a movie that came out amongst superheroes and
yeah.
dinosaurs and all these
yeah.
big movies that everybody, that are great and people want to see.
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing against those movies, and I think people should go see them. But I think then people are saying, oh, but also there's this other little
yeah.
movie you should go see. So I think there's this word of mouth and this buzz kind of slowly building around
mm-hmm.
our movie. People are discovering the songs, discovering it.
Yeah.
So I hope that we have a long summer
yeah.
ahead of us. And I'm obviously extremely excited to be getting my first proper international release.
Absolutely. And then, you know, what will be next for the film? Will it be going kind of around the world? And
yeah, I mean, on August 3rd, I know it's coming out in like 20 or 30 cinemas in the UK. Mm-hmm. Something like that. So that's great. And then, yeah, it's going to be in Asia. It's going to be in Latin America. It's going to be in the Netherlands. It's going to be kind of all Mexico. It's going to be all over the world. And I think that's incredible that this movie will have sort of a life beyond America or North America. I've never had that before. Well, and I think that speaks to the power of music.
Absolutely. And that seems the perfect note to end on. Thank you so much for talking with me, and thank you so much for the film. It's I don't think I'm going to shut up about it for the next few months. And if it doesn't get nominated for an Oscar for comedy, let alone drama, there'll be a writing camp.
Yeah, well, see. Yeah, we'll see what happens. I try not to think about all that stuff and just hope that the movie finds an audience and keeps kind of trucking along.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Man. Nice to meet you, man. Yeah.
So there we go. Thanks again to obviously Brett for joining us during the Edinburgh Film Festival, and hopefully you share his passion as well for this movie if you've seen it and or are going to see it in the future. So as always, I just always like to know as well, Dallas, what else have you been kind of watching the past week?
It's been a busy week for me, so I haven't been able to get to the cinema too much, but I did manage to catch The Escape earlier this week, and that's a film which had debuted earlier this year at the Glasgow Film Festival. And it stars Gemma Arterton as a young woman who's in a marriage, and she's married with two kids, but it's clear from the very sort of first scene that she's not happy in that relationship and in that sort of world. She sort of drifts along aimlessly. It starts off actually really quite uncomfortable to watch because, you know, sort of wakes up in the morning and then the husband, sort of played by Dominic Cooper, is, you know, wanting a quickie before work, and you know, she does have sex with him, but she's clearly not enjoying it. Makes for very uncomfortable viewing and gets you in that sort of headspace of where she is. She's got two kids, two young kids. One, I think, is slightly on the sort of autistic or additional support needs spectrum. And she has great sort of trouble sort of getting him to school and stuff like this. And she's just at the end of her tether. And it's about exploring sort of how, you know, the film's called The Escape. So I think it's fair to say that she's looking to plan an escape from all this, but she doesn't know what to do or when to do it. And the film is basically just sort of following her along this journey about until she gets to a tipping point. But what's great about the film is, you know, Gemma Arterton is very good as well, but Dominic Cooper is great in that he's not a complete ass, so to speak. You know, he it's obvious at certain times that he does love this woman and he wants to, you know, be with her and try and make things work, but she is just completely sort of closed off and is completely just wanting to get away. And so it's not as cut and dry as you'd think in terms of the relationship. You know, if he'd been a complete bastard and he'd been hitting her and stuff like that, it would have been, everyone would have been like, oh, absolutely, she should leave. She should get away from him. But, you know, it's slightly more complicated than that. And it's just a really sort of a interesting sort of character study. And, yeah, no, it's sort of one of those films which doesn't get sort of wide release, but it's something that people should check out. And it's probably something that, you know, Gemma Arterton will probably be nominated for Best sort of Actress around maybe like the Independent, British Independent Film Awards or the Spirit Awards or something like that. But my wife thought I was reading too much into it because there's a point in sort of two-thirds of the way through where we actually find out her first name, and it was Tara, and I thought that meant Tara, like as in, I'll see you later, Tara. You know, I was probably perhaps reading too much into this and thinking that her name meant something, but everyone else said I was reading too much into it, but I don't know.
I think I could go along with that. Yeah.
I thought it was quite, like, oh, okay, I see what they're doing there, but, you know, it's maybe watching too many films and I'm just reading too much into the decision to call her that. So.
The Escape was a movie I was really disappointed to miss out on. It was here for a week and then before it got shipped up to Aberdeen. And it was a movie that I remember one day I was like, oh my God, I've got a time slot that I can see it in. But it just never worked out in the end. I actually got the days all mixed up. So I really want to see it. Hopefully it'll be out maybe on streaming by the end of the year. So I'm very, very excited. I like Gemma Arterton and, you know, Dominic Cooper. So colour me excited for this.
Yeah, so what else have you caught up with in this week then?
Yeah, the only film I saw at the cinema this week was Christopher Robin, which I actually found to be quite highly enjoyable, actually. It's, you know, I don't want to go into it sort of too much because I know you haven't seen it yet, but I think it's a lovely movie. It's definitely well worth seeing. I mean, I really don't get the chance to watch too much movies at home, so I've really kind of been binging a bit on kind of Netflix and so on the past week, and something I needed to get my kind of kick my butt into gear with was the hashtag 52 films by women thing. Last year I saw quite a few people I know kind of got into it. Basically what it is it's something that originated with the WIF, which is the Women in Film, which kind of covers film, TV, media and digital, where it's like the disparity between male and female directors, we all know, is just quite unbelievable. And you know, I think it's like 6% of perhaps movies released or something along those lines are directed by women. So I haven't had, you know, and I looked at my list of Letterboxd movies from last year and I went, right, how many movies out of like the 140 odd did I see that were actually directed by women? And it was quite a poor return, you know, it was maybe it just scraped over double digits. And that's where someone like myself that does go see a lot of independent films likes to see new, old, everything in kind of between. And yeah, I was a bit disappointed with that. So this year I've really tried to kind of really embrace that. And, you know, I made the little Letterboxd list, which is always a good way to kind of keep me on track. And I looked at it the other day and I think I was only on 15 for the year. And I've seen about maybe like 130 films already. So I sat down with Netflix, wrote out a big list of movies that were on there, movies that I had that I really wanted to push on with. So kind of in the past few days, I've watched 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 movies, varying in quality, that is, directed by women, you know, sort of. So I'm now in the early 20s with my list, and it's something I want to kind of try and keep up to the end of the year and, you know, go beyond that 52, because there's so much when you actually dive into Netflix that is available to watch. Some of my favorite films that I've got there on DVD, I haven't maybe watched them in a little while, so I'm gonna watch those kind of things as well. So, you know, watch things like The Bling Ring, Lost in Translation, the new Netflix movie Like Father this week. I watched the Citizen 4 documentary, you know, just kind of a few different bits and pieces I've been kind of watching. So I'm going to try and watch as many kind of movies directed by women at home and while I get the chance over the next kind of few weeks, and really, you know, commit to that pledge and try and make this a bit of a yearly thing and hopefully encourage others to do it too.
Absolutely. I saw you posted on the sort of social media group we have yesterday about that, so I actually have been going through my list, and I think I'm probably only on something about like 8 or 9 for the year. So yeah, no, I really need to crank that up. But yeah, I think just looking through it, it's like just purely going to like a multiplex or whatever, there is no way you would be able to do that in a year. So yeah, you need to sort of check out your independent cinemas. You need to be going on Netflix and finding stuff like that. Because I mean, in terms of like big cinema releases, I think I've seen in the cinema, I mean, I'm looking at like Lady Bird and also You Were Never Really Here, but beyond
Blockers
that...
Blockers would probably be the biggest, probably one in terms of getting an audience this year, I think.
Oh, okay, I didn't actually get to see that one at the cinema. So, but I think I Feel Pretty had a duo directors. One of them was a woman. So,
And then The Spy Who Dumped Me is female directed as well.
Is it okay? Right, then I'll definitely have to check that out. But yeah, otherwise, Patrick starring the pug. That was by a woman as well. So yeah, but otherwise, yeah, no, I need to get onto that and start getting my average up, because I think it's a great thing. I've seen a few people do it in the last couple of years, and it's something that I really need to get into as well.
Exactly, and it'd be one of those ones, I think, like, even though you're on 8, it doesn't take too much of, you know, a couple Netflix movies a week, or, you know, a few films, I would say there's a few kind of on the horizon at the multiplex, you know, to get that kind of total. And I think it's one of these ones that, you know, I think once you get a kind of roll and you think, right, you know, it's not like sort of an affirmative action where you're thinking, right, I'm purposely going to watch movies directed by women. It's just maybe being sort of more conscious and thinking like, well, for me anyway, of like, yeah, I could watch this on Netflix, but it's maybe sort of thinking, right, which one's been directed by a woman? And it's not always a guarantee of quality. You know, some of the movies I watched in the past few days, you know, some of them were fantastic. You know, something like Lost in Translation, Bling Ring, amazing. I watched a documentary this morning all about Mira Sharapova while she had her year out with from tennis after a drugs ban. And it was genuinely absolutely awful as well. So the quality is much and such the same as any sort of, you know, male director, but it's just one of these ones that's trying to kind of just, you know, highlight that these movies are there, and the fact that we are sometimes having to scrape the barrel in terms of only having to rely on Netflix and streaming services or picking up DVDs to find these movies is a bit telling in itself. You know, as you say, if we did it in a multiplex, we'd never get it done.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, I think it's one that I'm definitely going to make the certainly a pleasure next year when I've got the full year to find it. But yeah, I'm just going to start looking around and seeing what I can find, and then I guess we can always share recommendations on here and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
And get people to join in and see what you can. But there's always films where you think, you know, there's a chance for it to be directed by a woman. Like Mamma Mia 2, no, mm-hmm. It was directed by a man. So yeah, the first one was directed by a woman, but the second one was directed by a man. So yeah, no, there's... Yeah, we need to see more and better representation. We're starting to see it on film, but yeah, absolutely, it's something that needs to happen behind the camera as well.
Absolutely. So obviously we've gone for what seems a very inappropriate one, a high fidelity top five again. Do you want to kind of tell people the rules that you put down when you picked this top five list and why it's been perhaps such a challenge for both of us?
Well, yeah, obviously with Hard to Beat Loud, we thought, you know, we always like to do top five, so I figured, right, we'll do one about music. But I didn't want to be about musicals. So these have to be films which are either about music, about songwriting, about musicians, or just about the music business in general. So you can't have any film where people just spontaneously start to burst into song and dance to tell the story. So, I mean, there's some films which were on the borderline, I think. Stuff like Blues Brothers and The Commitments are ones which, you know, some people classify them as musicals. It's more films where bands are performing musical numbers. I know in Blues Brothers there's a lot more dancing, but then, you know, there's a big car chase at the end where they smash like 142 cars. So, you know, it all balances out. But for this, we're looking at sort of music documentaries or films about the music business, about musicians, about music in general. So that was the rules. But I know we've both had a bit of trouble. I've actually been, as we've been talking, sort of moving things up and down the list. I had like about sort of 15 I could have had in my top five, but my top three are locked, but we'll see as we go. Actually, I don't have that long to decide what. No, I'm locking it now, so I'm good to go. So yeah,
it's a lock.
Yeah, so I'll start with my number five, and it's going to be a slightly odd choice, but I'm going to justify it. Okay, so my number five is Katy Perry, Part of Me, the music documentary about one of her tours. And now this is one which, you know, I wouldn't think I would have liked it, but I was going through a year where I watched about 200 films at the cinema. I'd set myself a target, so I was watching anything and everything. And then this one came up, and you know, I like some Katy Perry songs, so I went along to see it, and it was your standard sort of, oh, let's follow someone on the tour and stuff like that. But there's a point halfway through. This was basically filmed at the time when she was going through a breakup with Russell Brand. And she basically, at one point, basically films her getting the phone call from him saying that, you know, it's over. And then she's going on ahead with the show. And there's a moment where she's like underneath one of these, she's on one of these platforms, which is going to basically pop up and put her on stage. And she's going to be at like some outdoor gig in Rio de Janeiro in front of like 50,000 or 100,000 people. And she's basically breaking down in absolute agony and tears and stuff like that. And then someone's basically says sort of like, you know, 5 seconds to go. And then she basically just composes herself. And then up she goes. And it's just like, you can see in that moment, you know, that she's an absolutely broken woman, but she knows that her fans are wanting to see her and whatever. So she's going to do it for the fans. And, you know, you can see it as that particular performance goes on. You can see her sort of like welling up and stuff and just overwhelmed by the reaction and stuff like that. And it's just that one particular moment in that documentary has just stayed with me. And yeah, that's why it's there. I'll apologize to my wife for not having the One Direction film, because that was the film we actually went to on our first date. But we actually bonded over, after talking about it, about the Katy Perry documentary more. So that's why that one's there and not One Direction.
I've seen the One Direction movie. I remember seeing it when I was up in Aberdeen staying for a few months. And With that, like, I was really surprised with the One Direction movie how much I actually liked it. Like, when Martin Scorsese randomly pops up and he says, like, my kids or our grandkids are really into you guys. And I really like the insight into that One Direction movie where you see what it's like to be, you know, a traveling, you know, musician, and what it's like on your family, and, you know, the parents that have the what is it they've got? They've got like the standouts kind of kicking around in the living room, just going like, it reminds me that he's still here in a way. And like, I genuinely thought that was quite an impressive movie. But the Katy Perry movie, co-directed by a woman, is, I agree with you, I actually think it's a really interesting documentary. And I think it's, you know, that scene where she, like, she is emotionally upset and she's, you know, she's just crashed out there on the thing, like, trying to encourage her out to go see her fans, like, that strength of will. But I always think it's really insight into, like, a marriage failing while on tour, and how brutally honest that is about, you know, her failings in the marriage, her husband, you know, Russell Brand, who's got many incredible failings in the movie, and how it's like she seems to be trying to make all this effort to reach out to him, and obviously it's slightly biased towards her, but like how she's being let down and how that's affecting her mental health and her being on tour. I genuinely thought it was a really surprising movie.
Yeah, no, it's, and it's all credit to her, because I mean, she could have easily said, no, this film isn't going out, I don't want this, you know, I don't want anyone to see it. She actually made the decision to put it out. But it reminded me of a wrestling documentary from many, many years ago called Wrestling in the Shadows, I think it was. It was the Bret Hart story, and it was about a documentary crew who were following Bret Hart in like the final year of his WWE contract before he was going to WCW. And they basically captured the full, what they called the Montreal Screwjob Survivor Series, where basically Vince McMahon decided that even though Bret Hart was meant to win and leave with the champion, leave as champion, he decided to screw him over and give Shawn Michaels a belt, even though Bret Hart never submitted. And basically, it actually followed them backstage, where basically Bret Hart knocked out Vince McMahon and stuff like that. And it was just one of those documentaries where you just happen to be, you're filming one story, but you're in the right place at the right time, and you get something else. Something even better than your wildest dreams. And it's just one of those great sort of sporting documentaries, which I really love. So that's a shout out to that. But again, nothing to do with music, that one.
Yeah, I definitely maybe need to. I never really sort of got into wrestling, so maybe that's something that's kind of totally passed me by. But yeah, I think it's safe to say we are both fans of the Katy Perry movie, and I think people might have preconceptions about this sort of being a fluffy documentary. In fact, it's kind of far from it.
Well, if you want to, you know, me to do a top five list of wrestlers turned actors, we can certainly do that. One episode, it would feature Jesse Ventura in Predator, of course. But you know, I'm sure there's performances by wrestlers which you've enjoyed in the movies, even if you haven't got into wrestling. But I can certainly recommend a few documentaries if you want to get into it that way.
Yeah, we'll have to do that. That definitely sounds like a top five for one day. I've also, for my number five, also picked a documentary. It's the Amy Winehouse documentary. Amy, I don't know if this is one that you've seen.
I have seen it, yeah. Basically, I was never really a huge Amy Winehouse fan, but I went to see it based on the strength of the director who'd done Senna a couple of years before. Mm. And yeah, no, it was a... Tell us why this is on your list.
Yeah, I picked it because I, you know, Amy Winehouse has got a hell of a voice on her, but she was never someone I particularly took much interest in. And I always remembered when I found out she died, it wasn't a surprise, and I remember being very judgmental, for better or worse, like going, well, you know, this is something that she's kind of brought upon herself, you know, her addictions, you know, she's got no one to blame for herself. It was like you could see this coming a million miles away, and that was really harsh of me. And I remember going to see the documentary because I'd heard a lot of good reviews about it all, and I thought, right, I definitely need to check this out. And then I was just blown away by this kind of documentary. And I remember at the time describing it to a friend like it's like watching Jaws. Like, you know, the shark is coming in for the kill the whole time. You know Amy Winehouse is doomed to join the 27 Club. But, like, there's so many moments when you think, oh, if this had happened, you know, she would have been saved. If she had done this, you know, tragedy would have been averted. but you just know it's still coming, that doing it, it's getting closer and closer, and you feel really tense and uncomfortable during the film. And it is, it's brutally frank and honest about the people around her, whether it's her husband, whether it's her father, that all are in enabling her addictions, her, you know, pushing her into fame, that, you know, she was a great musician, but being on tour and such things like that were pushing her towards the kind of drug lifestyle. And there's a scene, there's a section where she's kind of got clean, you know, she's doing well, but her dad is like pushing her back onto tour. He's really enabling her, and you know, she was in, had so many poisonous people around her that basically doomed her. And it's just one of these ones. It's a harrowing watch, and to feel tense and uncomfortable when you know the outcome is just, you know, it's a really interesting experience. And I thought, you know, I came out of it having so much more respect and understanding about the life that, you know, she led, that led to that moment. And it wasn't just her addictions that I kind of, you know, foolishly thought were her own downfall, but there was a lot of people around her that kind of brought her to that. And I think for a documentary like that, which had, you know, the full investment of the people, of her family and her friends, it's no holds barred. And I think it's brilliant. I really, really recommend it. And you know, it's a real insight into, you know, an individual's downfall.
Absolutely. I mean, it was absolutely, it deserved to win the BAFTA and the Oscar that year. I thought it was one of those ones. Again, I was probably the same. I wasn't really a huge Amy Winehouse fan leading up to it. I mean, I probably knew more about her from what you read in the papers and online and stuff like that, about her drug addiction rather. And she became more famous, certainly in the UK. It was more about following her during her drug addiction and the downfall of Amy Winehouse rather than about the singing, which is what it should be. But this film, you know, gave me a different perspective on her. And that's what documentaries should do. It should, you know, provide you a window into a world which you weren't really aware of, and, you know, basically broaden your mind and change your mind on, and your perceptions on things which you weren't really educated on before. And yeah, no, an absolutely brilliant choice at number five.
Excellent. So what's your number four then?
Number four is one that I think you've mentioned already, so it's probably going to be on your list as well, but one of the most purely enjoyable films about music over the last couple of years, as you've already said, and that's Sing Street for me.
That's my number four as well.
That's your number four. Yeah, excellent. Yeah. Well, we can talk about it just now then. So yeah, it's one of those films which, again, I don't think I really knew much about going into the cinema, but it was one of those ones which I just enjoyed from the first moment to the last. It's written and directed by John Carney, who'd also done Once, I think it was, and it's the strength. I mean, this film is like a coming-of-age film about a young boy in Dublin whose parents are going through a divorce, you know. He's at that age where he wants to get out and explore the world, and the only way he can do that at the moment is through music. So he decides to put a band together. They start writing songs, they start recording videos on VHS and stuff like this. And the reason, you know, it's a classic sort of coming of age story, but what really makes it work is the quality of the songs. I mean, Riddle the Model is great in that sort of new romantic sort of Duran Duran sort of style, and it's, you know, the story advances at this point when he gets, you know, an older girl at the school to sort of model in the video, and then he gets infatuated with her, even though that relationship looks doomed from the outset. But, you know, he still can't stop himself from sort of falling in love with her. And, I mean, yeah, that whole drive it like you stole it moment is just one of the sort of best sort of musical numbers of the last sort of 5 years, I would say. What do you think?
Yeah, it was a film that I kind of went into, you know, not knowing too much. Like, I really liked John Carney, like, Once. I had it on my list, but then I don't know why I took it off a little bit, because I was like, I can only put one John Carney movie on. So I loved Once, and even though it's not in the top five, does not mean I don't love it. I definitely do. But you know, Begin Again is sort of second music movie. I enjoy. I'm just not a big fan of sort of Keira Knightley in the role. Certainly John Carney, from his interview a few years ago, which caught attention, wasn't a big fan either. But Sing Street kind of spoke to me, especially as a young guy. like, you know, it's always that idea of like making things to impress people, like women, like a lot of teenagers are doing that. You know, I certainly did it, and I remember being in a band for a little while, and I was a singer and I can't sing for toffee. So yeah, like it was really good to watch things like that. And the music, you know, Riddle of the Model, you know, the is, I love that blending of different styles, that it feels like such a great 80s period piece. And you know, Farida Wallace Pilo, who plays Cosmo Connor, is, you know, he's brilliant, and Lucy Boitana, you know, so good in these roles. Like these leading actors that kind of came from nowhere are fantastic. I just loved it, and I remember, you know, crying watching the movie for the first time, much like I did with Hearts Beat Loud. I'm a sucker for a coming of age musical, and I remember that I cried at the end. It was the line where it's like he's heading off to the UK, and his brother's like, you know, you're a jet stream, etc. And I just started kind of getting emotional. And then like a few months later, I was introducing my girlfriend to the movie, and I was like, oh, we should watch this. And I just started crying again at the same point. I was like, that is like sums up the movie. If that same moment can make you cry twice, that is something that's you're doing really well. Like, I always cried twice during Fall, once when I saw that at the cinema, and it was always at Falling Slowly when they perform that at the end and she gets the piano. That got me every time. So John Carney knows how to press my buttons. It's fantastic. It's, you know, for a film that as small as this, you know, the fact that it made like nearly 14 million at the box office is incredible, and how it didn't win an Oscar, you know, I don't think it even got nominated
It didn't get nominated for any of its songs, but it did get nominated for Best Musical or Comedy at the Golden Globes, even though I wouldn't classify it as a musical.
No, very few
it's
things.
On our list.
Yeah, very it's, few it, things actually class- get. The, you know, it's whenever you see the musical and comedy thing in, what's it called? Like the Golden Globes, it really is ripping the piss, isn't it?
Well, you know, I don't think they've ever recovered from the year The Martian won Best Musical or Comedy. I mean, okay, it's got some funny lines in it. It's certainly not a comedy. I mean, it's not a drama. It's science fiction. But, you know, they don't have a science fiction category. So, yeah. I mean, yeah, you never really know what's up with that. But, I mean, I just remembered Hugh Jackman's face when James Franco won Best Comedy Actor for his role as Tommy Wiseau. And he's just sitting there going, what? He clearly hadn't seen that movie, because if he had seen that movie and he'd met Tommy Wiseau, he would have known how good that performance was. And it was
absolutely
right that James Franco won that one, although having seen The Greatest Showman about two or three times now, I would absolutely admit that Hugh Jackman probably would have deserved that award equally, but, you know, c'est la vie.
Exactly, yeah. So we both are in agreement, number four. I wonder if our next three are going to link up, because obviously your top three were in the can. So I'm very curious to know what was so good that made that top three.
Well, I mean, I would argue against, you know, anyone who says that any of these three films should not be on there. But number three is Whiplash.
Oh, that just didn't make my cut. That was...
Oh, okay. But, you know, Whiplash for me is one of those films, even if the rest of the film was utter garbage, it still would have made my top five for the final scene alone. Mm-hmm. So if anyone hasn't seen Whiplash, please check it out. I think it's probably on Netflix at the moment. But it's about a young man who's wanting to be a drummer, and he's at music school, and he's learning to drum, and he wants to get into the jazz band led by J.K. Simmons. And this is a role that J.K. Simmons won an Oscar for, and he basically won an Oscar for basically coming up with the most creative uses of swearing that year outside of Malcolm Tucker. And it's utterly deserved Oscar win, because he's such a force of nature in this. He's basically that teacher that drives people to be the absolute best versions of themselves at music. However, he will totally crush their emotional state at the same time as doing it. He basically builds these people up and then crushes them down. You know, they might play a great solo one day, the next day he's throwing a chair at their head because, you know, they've mistimed something. And Miles Teller plays this drummer, and basically it gets to this point where there's a final scene where he's been humiliated by J.K. Simmons, and basically comes back and starts to play Whiplash, this one song, and you basically get about an 11-minute version of this song with about 6 minutes of drum solos. Now, it's not always Miles Teller doing it. You know, he's doing quite a lot of the drawing, but he can't do the close-up hand shots or whatever. But the editing in that scene is absolutely sensational and quite rightly won the Best Editing Award at that year's Oscars. I thought it was going to go to Birdman just because most of the other awards were going to Birdman at that time. But they realised that, you know, taking five or six shots, extended shots in a movie and making that one shot is not as good as the editing in that final scene. And just, it just gets me every time. It's just such a thrilling, breathtaking, you're basically holding your breath the entire time as it builds and builds and builds. And, you know, finally there's this moment where you realise that, you know, Miles Teller says earlier about, you know, he'd rather be like Charlie Parker was dead at 34, but everyone knew his name. He said, I'd rather be dead at 34 and everyone know my name than live a long life and no one knows who I am. And his dad is sort of watching this moment and he can see that Miles Teller is going to push himself to the brink to become famous, but at the expense of everything else. And J.K. Simmons is going to enable him to do this. And it's just, it's heartbreaking, but you know, it's almost like a triumphant. You want to punch the air at the moment when he finally sort of hits that final note and you're just like, oh, it's just incredible film. And yeah, no, absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I can't add anything more to that. Like, I remember it's one of these movies that is probably great to watch at home, whether it's on Netflix, I'm sure. But like with a movie like this, you're like, oh my God. Like, see, when you watch that in the cinema, like, it's the intensity, you know, everything on a big screen, the sound as well. Like, I just feel a bit frustrated that he's maybe not starred in anything as good since. I really thought that was going to be, like, J.K. Simmons, like, exploding into, like, great films and stuff. But he's reduced to sort of bit parts in some movies, it seems, since. You know, even Justice League. I feel a bit frustrated for him, actually.
Yeah, no, I don't know if it's just, you know, the way that he works and whatever, but I mean, he always sort of excels in these sort of, yeah, these sort of bit parts and sort of supporting characters. He is one of those sort of supporting actors who just sort of elevates anything that he's in, even if he isn't in them for long enough. But you know, hopefully he will find that sort of lead role that that he deserves. And but you know, I'll take sort of Fletcher any day of the week. So what have you got at your number three?
Yeah, this is always the stage where I start wondering if we've crossed over again with any points, but I've picked the 2007 film Control. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, but that's not on my list, so yeah.
Yeah.
Save for another round.
Yeah, Joy Division's Ian Curtis examines sort of, as anyone that sort of knows Ian Curtis and Joy Division, Ian Curtis committed suicide, he hung himself and had a notorious history with depression. And the film's sort of in black and white, and it's shot by Anton Corbijn, who is, you know, famous for sort of his photography, you know, film shooting bands. This is like his feature film, I believe. And then it's all about sort of following that life that Ian Curtis had in Mansfield and sort of the middle of England. But I just find it a movie that just sort of grips you. And then it's another one, again, I don't know what it says about me, because there's also another film on my list that sort of ends with a bit of a tragedy as well, but there's something about watching this where it's like, you know, the black and white, you know, knowing the tragedy of the story, and you know, something like, you know, Joy Division, the music they made was incredible and beautiful, you know, the lyrics, you know, Love Will Tear Us Apart is one of the most well-known and played songs ever made. And it's just like tragedy is going to kind of come to this guy, and it's as you're watching it, as it starts to unfold, and you know how what drives one of the most talented people in the world to kill themselves. You know, we could all talk about, did Amy Winehouse put herself in a position where she essentially was killing herself, but she faced a lot of challenges around the world with that. But with this, it's like, this is a man that chooses to kill himself. What is it about his life, you know, his epilepsy as well, you know, the medication, the seizures. It was like he was almost at a time where the help that he needed was still sort of out of date. It wasn't as progressive as it should have been, and it ultimately cost him his life. I thought it was one of the best films I've kind of ever seen, you know, on a first time watch, and it's something that's stuck with me ever since. It's a terrifying watch, but it's brilliantly acted. You know, Sam Riley, you know, this is one of his first ever films, is absolutely sensational. Samantha Morton, as always. I highly recommend people watch this movie. It's one of the best representations of disability on screen and what drives someone to kill themselves, you know, at the height of their fame.
Yeah, no, this is actually a film which I actually haven't seen. I remember it sort of screened at the Belmont when I was working there, but it's one that I never actually got round to seeing. But just going on what you've said just then, I'm going to have to absolutely seek it out and give it a watch again. It's always fascinating watching these films about, you know, bands and the music which you know and love, but you don't really know the history of the bands and stuff like that. So therefore, you actually get a better idea of sort of how these sort of things came to pass, and thankfully not in a way that you get in these awful musicals. I think it was Jersey Boys was one that I saw recently that basically shoehorned in like a really sort of obvious signposted way about how they created their best songs and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, they're watching a movie where it's like some guy slaps a girl like across the face in like a Western or something. It's like, wow, look at that. And he says, and then some guy's like, oh, well, you know, tough girls don't cry. And it's like, ooh, girls don't cry. It's like, oh, God. Big Girls Don't Cry. It's like, geez, oh, come on, really? That's how you came up with that song? It's absolute nonsense. But no, I love sort of films like this. So yeah, no, it's definitely one I'm going to have to check out.
Absolutely. So what's your number two?
I have a feeling, yeah, there might be potential for crossover at this point now. But my number two is 2000's Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous.
It didn't go on my list, but it was one of those ones. It was on the long list originally.
Okay, but I saw this film in the cinema when it came out and just sort of fell in love with it. I think this was probably one of the first Cameron Crowe films I'd seen, and now I've seen basically everything that he's done. But I just love the story of this sort of young writer who basically manages to blag a job for Rolling Stone to sort of cover this band and go all across America touring with them, trying to get the story, but needs, you know, this one particular interview before he can call it a day. But the guy keeps saying, oh, we'll do it in the next time, we'll do it the next time, come along, come and join us and stuff like this. And, you know, it's just got one of the best casts, you know, I've seen. It's got Frances McDormand, Zooey Deschanel, but if it's got Jason Lee's an actor who Cameron Crowe managed to get the best out of along with Kevin Smith, but it's just a shame that we don't really see him in much these days. It's got Billy Crudup, but I mean, it's the great Philip Seymour Hoffman as Lester Bangs, sort of the real life journalist. And there's just one quote that he gives the guy, you know, he phones him up late at night going, basically, I've screwed the pooch on this one, you know, I can't get the interview, you know, everything's wrong, you know, I've made friends with the band, you know, you're not meant to make friends with the band, you know, you're meant to be objective and stuff like that. He says, you know, the only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone when you're uncool. I know that's one of those quotes which has stuck with me all this time. And, you know, it's, even if, you know, you might not feel you fit in, you know, there are other people out there who love the same stuff as you do, as much as you do. And it's just making that connection. And, you know, that it's got those great, some great musical moments in it. Some of the Stillwater songs are great, sort of Fever Dog. But I mean, the one that always sticks out is that sort of Tiny Dancer moment on the bus.
Absolutely. It's the classic moment.
Yeah, I mean, the band have completely fallen out by this point. You know, they were on a plane and it was felt like they were going to crash, and they all started basically saying all these things to each other that they'd meant to say, and all these sort of secrets were exposed, and they're all sort of silently walking onto the bus, and then Elton John starts to play, and then one starts to sing along, and then basically you get this group sing along at the end, and then everything's right in the world again because of Elton John, which is, you know, a good rule to have, I say.
Absolutely. I remembered me and my friends singing along to Tiny Dancer many a time on a night out around those early 2000 periods when the sort of, I think it was one of these movies that didn't make much of a splash at the cinema, but again, it sort of made, you know, things on like the DVD market at the time, rentals, that seemed to be when it's kind of found its home. And I think it's is just genuinely a modern classic, and I wish I had space in my list for it.
Yeah, no, I think it's one of the films which I think I've got the DVD that's got like the original version, and then there's like a director's cut or something, which is about 3 hours long. And I can't remember the differences between the two. It's just one of those ones where I think they kind of meld into one, and it doesn't really matter what version I'm watching, I always enjoy it. And it's just, yeah, it's just got great music. It's not even just about music, you know, it's about finding that fandom that you connect with, that band, that, you know, TV show, that film, or something that you really, really love. And, you know, I've gone on to do writing and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's a film which is sort of close to my heart as well.
Yeah, it's well earned. I can see why it was definitely a lock in your list.
Yep, so what have you got at your number two?
Yeah, I've gone for the 2004 documentary Dig. I don't know if you're familiar with this one.
It's another one which I've missed, so please tell us all about it.
It is like Andy Warhol.
Is this the story of Anvil, or is it? No, this is. No, that was Anvil, the story of Anvil. What's Dig about?
Dig is about. So, in the early 2000s, the Andy Warhols with Bohemian Like You kind of exploded onto the mainstream. But they were sort of prodigies of this other band called the Brian Jonestown Massacre, who are very much this sort of cult band. You know, they didn't have much of a, you know, mainstream attention, but like they had a kind of a cult following. And their lead singer, Anton, you know, he's a character, to put it lightly. Anton Newcombe, he's the lead singer of the Brian Jonestown Massacre, and he's got his drink and drugs worries. And as the Andy Warhol's fame starts to rocket, you know, they're performing all over the world. You know, they had the big Vodafone advert. Anton becomes bitterly jealous of sort of the Andy Warhol's fame. You know, he starts sending them bullets in the post. He starts having meltdowns on stage. They became notorious for their gigs where, like, Anton was such a perfectionist, he would scream and hurl abuse physically sometimes at the members of the Brian Jonestown Massacre. And that toxic attitude to his art, you know, breaks apart his relationship, his marriage, it causes issues with his children. It's unbelievable what kind of happens with this movie. You're watching it and you're in shock when you watch it the first time. I was like, when this movie came out, it was one of these ones I'd been on and out in Glasgow, had a few hours to kill before the bus home. And it was at this stage where cinemas weren't dominated by 3D and 4DX and all these different options. So like a movie like Dig could get a place in a cine world. So I got the chance to watch this movie. And it's one of these ones you come out and you start telling people, you got to see this film. Oh my God, have you heard this story? And like, it seems to really sort of jumpstart the Brian Jonestown Massacre as a band afterwards. And you would have people going to see them to see the potential car crash on stage. I saw them maybe a year or two after this movie came out in Glasgow. And there was a bit of tension at one point on the stage and people were shouting, like chanting, fight, fight, fight. Your mind's blowing. You're like, what is this I'm watching? And you know, they've become a bit more seasoned in their age, but it's such a fascinating insight into such a toxic man, and to see the different fames and where these bands were at the early 2000s. It's a documentary which really needs to be seen to be believed.
Yeah, no, it's that will definitely be going on my must-see list. And because, yeah, no, I remember sort of Andy Warhol's from all that time when they exploded, and so it'd be interesting to see this. And yeah, it sounds like again a sort of being at the right place at the right time, where you sort of get this amazing story where it might have just been them following sort of these two bands on gigs, and then this sort of rivalry comes up. So yeah, no, absolutely, it's one that I'm definitely gonna have to watch now. So
I can't wait to hear your thoughts on
Netflix. So yeah, so we've reached the number one stage, and I'm interested to see if we've got the same one at the top. It's probably going to be no surprise what my number one is, given the name of my blog and stuff like that. So I might go to you and find out if you've got the same one first.
No.
So what's your number one?
We don't have the same one.
We don't have the same one. You know what I'm going to do? Okay.
Yeah. I like High Fidelity. It's a good movie. I haven't watched it in years, I think. This one was so hard because, like, I was thinking about things like Spinal Tap, Scott Pilgrim, A Mighty Wind. So many films I could pick for this top five list, but I just decided to go with Amadeus, the story of the rivalry between Wolfgang and Mozart. And oh my God, I just absolutely love it.
Like, Scaleri, is it?
Yeah, Salieri. Yeah. So it's one of these ones, like, the music is just absolutely incredible, and to watch this sort of rivalry between Salieri and Mozart, you know, Mozart, we know the music, we know the man, well, we don't know the man, but like this film gives us an insight into what potentially Mozart was like. I think when we think of like a Mozart, we think of a serious man, a very regal perhaps person, but in reality he's such this larger than life character. You know, he has this laugh in the film, this ha 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 ha, and it is just interesting to see how music comes so easily to him. The fame and attention that he gets that just provokes Salieri to madness, and eventually to murder. And I think it's one of the greatest films of all time. And I think I saw a tweet last week where it was like, someone was like, Amadeus, one of the most underrated movies of all time. And someone was like, yeah, it won all these countless Oscars and nominations. And, you know, but I do think there's an underrated element to it. You know, you don't find many people talking about, yeah, it was revered at the time, but you don't hear many people our age or anything going, oh, Amadeus, check it out, or this or that. So I highly recommend people see this movie, and I got to see it live last year with a live orchestra. So to hear Salieri's music, Mozart's music accompany a film like this was just an incredible experience, and that's what's put it into the number one position. And I think, you know, it's definitely one of the greatest movies of all time, not just of its genre, but just in general. It's just a masterpiece.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic film, and I can understand why you've got it at your number one, especially if you managed to see it with a live orchestra score, which I imagine was just an incredible, incredible moment.
Yeah, so, I think, yeah, well earned. As I say, a lot of movies could be my number one movie, and a lot of movies could be in my top five, but this is just the way it's fallen on this Sunday.
Yeah, any given Sunday, as we did with our sports movies, yeah, on any absolutely. Given Sunday, anyone could win. But there was always going to be one winner for me, and that has to be High Fidelity. It's one of my favourite films of all time. It's my all-time favourite book. And, you know, it tells the story of Rob Gordon, a guy who runs a failing record shop. In the book, it was London, but in the film, it's been transferred over to Chicago, and John Cusack plays Rob Gordon and sort of narrates the story to the camera and the audience as he is dumped by his girlfriend, or breaks up with his girlfriend, and then decides to figure out where he's going wrong and goes back through his all-time top five breakups in order to figure out what he's doing wrong and how he can improve to win this girl back. And it's just a great look at, well, relationships, but also about music. And I sort of view films probably in the same way that Rob Gordon does with music. So, you know, I've tackled The Great Reorganization at one point. I have got my DVD collection filed by autobiographical order. So if anyone ever asks, you know, for a certain film, I'm the one that has to go and find it, because I know that I watched that film at a particular time. Things will move around depending on when we watch them and stuff like that. So, you know, if a film becomes more associated with a certain memory, I'll move it to that section and stuff like that. So that's what I always do. But it's just got a great cast. I mean, it's the first film that I probably really saw, sort of Jack Black, and I don't think I was aware that Tenacious D were a thing at this point. When he suddenly sort of busts out, you know, let's get it on at the end, when he's been sort of teasing Rob the whole way through about being in this heavy metal death band and stuff, and then they come on and do some Marvin Gaye at the end. It's just quite a shock to the system, but it's just a great film about relationships and one of my all-time ones. And even though there is, you know, a point where they do get films wrong, when the whole sequence about what would it mean to you, that sentence, I haven't seen Evil Dead 2 yet, and then Jack Black's talking about the soundtrack, and then the guy making shotgun ammo off camera in the 19th century, and it's like, well, no, that's Evil Dead 3, Army of Darkness. But you know they get that wrong, but everything else to me is pretty much perfect. And yeah, it's my all-time top number one film about music.
There we go. It's a lock for today on our top five.
Yeah. Absolutely. It could never have been anything else, really.
No, I knew that from moment one that I was going to do that. So I wish I'd put some money on it.
Yeah, no, well, it's not like I didn't pick the topic just to put High Fidelity at my number one. The topic was linked to today's film. So.
I know, I did have to knock back your original top five list of top five movies about Joan Cusack working in a record shop. So, you know, you got there eventually.
I would actually potentially struggle to do top five Joan Cusack films these days, you know, apart from Gross Point Blank and High Fidelity. I mean, there's a guy who went off the deep end and now just makes terrible films. Although, actually, Love and Mercy, he was actually pretty good in that.
Yeah, that was originally... That made it was on my top five, actually.
Oh, was it? Really?
Yeah, but it came off at the last minute. That is a brilliant film.
Look at you trying to work in ways of getting more films onto the list. I mean, I could easily say I thought about School of Rock, Searching for Sugar Man, etc. 8 Mile was one which nearly made the list at one point. But, I mean, there's just so many great films. Inside Llewyn Davis was another one.
Yeah. We could have picked 11 films for this.
Well, yeah, we could have gone to 11 with it. But if neither of us had Spinal Tap, it would have been very awkward.
Absolutely.
Which is actually, neither of us did have Spinal Tap. So.
No, it should have been on. It could have been. I'm almost regretting not putting it on the list. But we better close up before I change my top five again. So
exactly. Yeah.
Thanks for joining me today, Dallas, and thanks to Brett for joining us again on the show. If people wanted to read your reviews and reach out to you, where can people find you online?
People can find me on Twitter at champcelluloid, or my reviews are on championshipcellular.blogspot.com. So come at me, bro. Tell me what I should have had on my list, what we shouldn't have had on the list, etc. We'd love to know what your favourite films about music, musicians, etc. are.
Excellent.
And where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Lee_Nostromo, and you can find me in your local cinema. So join us again next week. We don't know what we'll talk about next week, but we'll definitely be back. And thanks very much for listening to our bumper musical episode. So this is our encore, and we're now exiting stage left. Bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.